This is Future Fork, a show that explores the world of food and the decisions we can make today that will shape our future. On the show, you'll hear from innovators in the food space. We'll have disruptive conversations with people from around the globe who are taking the lead on topics like food sustainability, ending world hunger, food security, and so much more. I'm your host, Paul Newnham. Today on Future Fork, I'm joined by Dr. Shweta Chakraborty. Shweta is a renowned climate behavioral scientist and risk management expert. And Shweta is also the US CEO of We Don't Have Time. We Don't Have Time is a movement and a tech startup that leverages the power of social media to hold leaders and companies accountable for climate change. In today's episode, Shweta breaks down what a climate behavioral scientist actually is. She takes us back to the origin of We Don't Have Time. And amongst all the big questions, Shweta shares her favorite thing to eat right now. All right, let's get started. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Just to get started, can you tell us a little bit about your journey to become a risk and behavioral scientist? Was that something that you always had in mind?
Okay, so throwing the question back to you and listeners, who knows what a risk and behavioral scientist is?
It's an interesting question. That's why I was keen to ask you, because I was like, oh, I know what a behavioral scientist is, but risk is kind of another addition. And I thought, what's that layer and how does that work?
And I'll adjust even further and say I call myself a climate behavioral scientist now because I'm applying the principles of behavioral science to climate specifically. And there's no obvious path to becoming a climate behavioral scientist because, well, one, I created it. I'm not really sure it exists otherwise. I'm going to see how this works and see how many others decide to call themselves climate behavioral scientists. And that's how I'll know maybe I was successful in forging this new career trajectory. But to answer your initial question, how I actually got here is I studied behavioral science. Behavioral science came from psychology. It's been around for 4 or 5 decades at this point. And the idea was to understand why people don't make rational decisions. Despite all the data we have, all the evidence and science we have about risks, and not just climate, but, you know, nuclear risks or the risks of just engaging in daily activities, like getting in your car or getting on a plane, not daily for everybody, but, you know, just all the decisions that involve some scope of risk. Why is it that we as humans don't actually recognize the actual level of risk to those activities? So we tend to, as humans, overreact to risks that aren't that serious, like plane crashes, for example, even though Boeing's been in the news quite a bit. So some of your audience might argue otherwise. But we tend to generally overreact to risks that aren't a big deal. And we really underreact to risks that are very serious. A good example of this in the climate space is sea level rise. It's a risk that's perceived as really slow moving and far in the future. And for that reason, we don't actually dedicate enough time and resources to protecting ourselves and safeguarding ourselves, our families, our communities against that future threat. So I'm fascinated by this. I'm fascinated by overreactions to risks that don't deserve that much time and attention, underreaction to risks that do, and how do we close that gap in perception and reality, right?
Yeah, no, it's super interesting. And I mean, being in DC where water level rise is going to be a big issue here, it is an interesting how people don't then think about that. So how was your journey and your early work shaped you to get to this point?
Yeah, so initially I thought I was going to use this field to improve health outcomes. So I was curious about why patients don't listen to their doctors when they're told to just, you know, exercise more or eat better. It seems like something that's a no-brainer. And these are experts telling you to do that. But again, humans underestimate the risks of bad things happening to them. We call it optimism bias, where we think it's going to happen to everybody else, but not to us. And so that is actually very recognizable, not just in health outcomes, but in the climate space where you see, like you just brought up flooding, right? You see citizens all over the United States and around the world of their respective countries that they are going to be protected from the relevant impact of climate. So here in DC, flooding is a serious risk. And let's actually take a poll of how many homeowners have flood insurance properly to cover themselves. we just don't think it's going to happen to us. And that to me is really fascinating. So I studied initially behavioral science as it related to patient outcomes. And then once I learned about the climate crisis and the insane risks that climate poses to people all over the world, I decided I had to apply behavioral science and contribute to helping people safeguard themselves and make decisions, like just simply around where to live. That's a big decision.
Yeah.
And making the wrong choice there could result in natural disasters, which we know now aren't natural anymore. They're being amplified through human-caused carbon emissions. And so there's nothing natural about it. They're increasing in frequency. They're increasing in probability. So humans need to know that. And so my goal is to communicate in a way so people know the real risks that they face, perceive them accurately, and properly protect themselves.
It's great to see you in the hot seat now as well, because you're normally the one that's doing the interviewing. Podcasts, interviews, you do a lot of press and facilitation. So before I go into a little bit more about what you're working on at the moment, who's someone that you've interviewed that was a real highlight in your career? And who's top of your list to interview if you get a chance?
Oh, I love that one. Okay, so Jane Fonda, she's the queen, 86 years old, depending on when this is being listened to, probably even older than that. And she has like all of the energy of any youth advocate for climate. She'll put most of us to shame in middle age, I think.
Amazing, yeah.
Did I just give away a middle age? Oh, dear God. When did that happen? Somebody hit 40 recently. So Jane Fonda was amazing, mainly because we're talking about decades of activism. Yeah. And so she can apply what she's learned in fighting for other just human rights to the climate fight. And there's so much overlap there, especially when it comes to environmental racism and justice and equitable benefit when all these solutions are actually implemented. We need to make sure that communities that are most vulnerable get a piece of the pie this time. They're not just having solutions put in their neighborhoods, but are actually contributing to it. And so Jane Fonda was a spitfire when I interviewed her on the main stage at South by Southwest 2024. And just the energy and the learning and the wisdom, I think, was really something that I recommend this audience listening to this watches. It'll really fire you up. And one of the best things she said, which I can't get out of my head now as a woman. She was like, you know, we could just stop sleeping with the fossil fuel industry. And it was just so true.
Yeah.
It was like, stop dating, stop sleeping with the fossil fuel industry. And let's just make them persona non grata. And then that actually could go a long way.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
And I loved it. And then who would I want to interview?
Yeah. Who would you want to interview? Who's on top of the list?
I would want to interview independent directors of fossil fuel companies.
Okay.
So maybe not a name in particular, although I could name some names in particular at Exxon, for example, but they're the ones who are actually making the decisions behind how oil and gas is, quote unquote, transitioning to clean energy, right? Yeah. Which your audience will be very familiar with is greenwashing at the moment until we actually see carbon emissions go down. But these are the kind of no-names that are really making the decisions, and they need more airtime because they hide behind the CEOs, and everybody is pointing the CEOs as villains, and they're the spokespeople of these companies, and they deserve to be held accountable. But I want to get into the brains of those who are actually making decisions behind who to appoint as the spokespeople and why to continue business as usual, because do you not exist on the same planet as us? And do you also not have children that are going to suffer impacts of climate change? So what are you thinking the future is going to look like? I would love to get time to truly pick their brains. Is it purely greed? Or is it really, you know, that guy in Don't Look Up that thought he was going to get into a spaceship, get to another world and exist because he was a billionaire? Maybe that's what's going on in their brains. But as a behavioral scientist, I just want to understand what their perception of risk is.
Amazing. That would be so interesting just to kind of get into that mindset and see where the fragmentation is, where's the separation, why are people not connecting the dots? So something you are working on, and even in talking to you, I always have this feeling of urgency. And you work for an organization called We Don't Have Time. Tell us, what is that?
So We Don't Have Time is an annoying name for me in the United States trying to explain the company, because companies in the U.S. are one word or maybe two combined. It's very European, especially Swedish, to have a company name like We Don't Have Time. But over the years, I've grown to love it because it's quite literally a catchphrase and the name of our company. And it explains really succinctly what we think and what we do. As soon as you realize we're in the climate space, then you can put together, we don't have time, we have to act because of the existential risk that is climate that's already affecting our lives. All of the different impacts are already underway. And so if we're going to find solutions to the impacts locally, regionally, globally, we have to get moving like yesterday. We don't have time. So it's very much the nature of the name is very much everything that we do as a company. It's to accelerate solutions to all of the negative and adverse outcomes that we know are coming from average global temperature increase. And that's going to affect some parts of the world way worse than others. But don't mince my words. Everyone and everywhere will be impacted by this. And so even some regions where there might be some perceived benefit, sure, we'll get some wine in places where grapes couldn't grow. That is so minuscule and it's very temporary because overwhelmingly this temperature point is not conducive to Earth systems, to humans, to animals, to plant life. We have never coexisted at a temperature point higher than what we've comfortably lived in and grown in and flourished in for several millennia. So now we're really experimenting with like a major shakeup that is going to affect every aspect of life on this planet. So we don't have time to, we don't have time to wait to really figure out how to address and solve this if we're going to ensure that the planet is hospitable to life.
Yeah. How did we don't have time start? Where did it come from?
So this is what I initially said Jane Fonda was one of my best interviews is because she's an activist at heart and we are an activist organization. We started really with Greta Thunberg. We kind of came up together. So she was sitting by herself in front of Swedish Parliament in 2017. The founder of our company, Ingmar Renshaug, happened to walk by and started talking to her. And there's footage of all of this. There's pictures and video. And then made the introduction to her, to the United Nations. And honestly, the rest was history after that. We Don't Have Time developed a strong relationship with both Greta and the UN. And Greta and the UN obviously developed a relationship. And the whole conversation of climate change was taken to another level. And so our origin story, We Don't Have Time's origin story, is very much the Greta Thunberg story as well. And it's also very much climate change becoming a major priority for the UN. Obviously, it's always been a goal, but becoming front and center, having its own attention brought to it during the United Nations General Assembly and the various climate conferences that take place every year, increasing in frequency, increasing in more kind of segmented pieces as well. So now we have a biodiversity conference that's more frequent. So it's all very much part of the same beginning, which is we are ignoring what scientists have been saying for decades. We're ignoring children that recognize this. And us adults in our respective roles and our respective levels of decision-making are not listening and not taking this seriously. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And would you say that's the biggest challenge that we're really facing?
As a scientist who uses communication as a tool to correct for that perception and reality gap that humans are dealing with, and which is why we've seen no movement forward that we need. I mean, we've seen movement forward for sure, but not movement that commensurates to the reality of what we're actually facing, I would say, absolutely, this is our biggest struggle. I think we have so many cool ideas on solving climate. We have so much passion, optimism, ingenuity. We've solved bigger problems than climate in the history of humankind. So what is this? It's a communications issue. It's not being able to get people to pay attention, prioritize, and allocate time and resources in a way that really commensurates. So once we solve that, we'll solve the climate crisis.
So what would you say gives you hope in this conversation?
The young people answer is like the easiest to say. I know everyone is going to say that, so I have to come up with something different. But I will say, I was saying this recently also, when you see the community that different groups are creating within the climate movement, right? And so young people are one example of that. There's like 100 of them now, I would say. And they show up. They show up to all of the global convenings, to the TED conferences, to the Aspen conferences, to the We Don't Have Time broadcast. They come in hordes. They come in groups. And they've really created a community that seems, I'm not just on the outside, also from the inside, that seems really cool and supportive with one another. So one of them said to me, the other day, and the reason I'm not saying the name is because I need to get the quote perfect because I don't want to misquote her, but action is the best antidepressant. And I love that, the concept
awesome.
Of that. Because
when
you bring people together and you create that community, it provides that hope that we actually have an opportunity not just to overcome this, but to also bond in the process. And us humans need that. So what gives me hope is seeing not just young people, but the various communities that have emerged and just the excitement of working together. And that action, that working together and that taking of that action is resulting in that antidepressant. Because otherwise, you can imagine, this is like scary stuff. And working in climate day in and day out, it can be demoralizing sometimes. It can be scary. It can be numbing, all of that. But if you have a great community of people to work with and you're really taking action steps towards doing the right thing, that's a massive antidepressant. I would even say it's like, it's actually a great high. It's a natural high.
Absolutely. So what's something that you've been really challenged by in the last year?
The biggest struggle is that despite all of the awakening and all of the education, all of the communication, we still are emitting more carbon every single year.
Yeah.
So you would expect that because we're adding more people to the planet and more people are consuming more. And so the combination of that means that we're not going to just education and awareness isn't enough. It's important. We need humans to recognize that every decision they make has a carbon impact. And it's important to measure our carbon footprints and to do our part. But please don't forget that carbon footprint was actually created by the fossil fuel industry to put the onus of responsibility on the consumer. And that is like a penny drop for a lot of people because, yes, we need to change behavior and we need to tell each other and the next generation that we have to do unto the planet as we want the planet to do unto us, the same way we've got the golden rule in how we teach our children, do unto others as you want to do unto yourself. So environmental stewardship should be ingrained intrinsically in human values across the globe. That is why it's important to think about your carbon footprint. That's why it's important to think about how you engage with the planet. But it's a dent in the bucket in terms of, or a drop in the bucket, rather, in terms of how to reduce global carbon emissions. Because the only way we're going to do that is to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
So for me, the best thing is the fact that we're everywhere. Everyone knows what's going on now. People are aware. People are asking about climate. Even your average person will recognize that climate change is something, right? And that's huge, especially in the United States, that you've got voters saying that it's in their top three issues. So all of that is great. But the disappointment is we still haven't actually addressed the major issue, which is got to stop pumping carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah. So in terms of food and agriculture communities, what role do you think they play? You've talked a bit about energy, but do you think food and agriculture plays a role in this?
I always talk about food and agriculture in the same vein as transportation and fashion and all of the biggest industry emitters. And if we have to prioritize, it's in the top three.
Yeah.
So yes, absolutely. We have to focus in on the sectors where we make the most impact. And food and ag for me is right there.
So if you were talking to somebody, what advice would you have for somebody who's keen to make an impact, like really trying to make an impact and frustrated by the lack of action? What advice would you give them?
Well, I hope you're hearing it in me. But at the same time, that frustration can be really powerful. If there's another person you know that's frustrated, get them to work with you on something. Now you're a team.
Yeah.
Get a third person, you're a group. Join an online campaign. Now you're a global movement, right?
Yeah.
You're contributing your voice. There's no reason to not get plugged in. We've made it so easy. The whole reason we don't have time exist is because of the frustration that, oh, I know I care. Nobody's asked me to do anything.
Yeah.
So we've made it so easy to do something and to do it for free, right? Just to contribute your time, your skills, your expertise. Just being a citizen of this planet means you have a role to play. You have something you owe the environment. And it's really easy to contribute your part, as little or as big as you want it to be. So I always say, download the We Don't Have Time app. It's totally free. And you can literally find your community almost right away. You can.
Amazing.
Do you care about food? Do you care about fashion? Do you care about, you know, electrification of vehicles? It's so easy to just plug into the areas that you really care about and to see what campaigns are underway, what's happening locally, what's happening globally, whatever level you're comfortable in. It's time to contribute your expertise, your skills, your creativity to solving some portion of this otherwise massive problem.
Just changing tack slightly, this is a question I like to ask everyone. What are you loving to eat at the moment? What are you enjoying?
I mean, beans came to mind right away, but it's also because it's here I am talking to
that's
the bean guy.
Yeah. No.
Quite frankly, beans are really good.
What sort of dishes? Tell me.
I'm really into chili.
Okay.
It's super simple.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more American than Mexican food.
Yeah.
So I'm really
I know you've just been in Texas. So
no, exactly. South by Southwest got me really into all various kinds of just like bean preparations.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the black beans, the pinto beans, and the, what are the other ones? The white ones. Actually, it's kidney. The three bean chilies.
Three bean chilies.
Yes, that's my jam.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this show.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Future Fork, a show that explores the world of food and the decisions we can make today that will shape our future. Future Fork is produced by Disruptive Consulting Solutions and supports the SDG2 Advocacy Hub. For more info, head to the website futureforkpodcast.com. This show was produced with strategy and production support from Wavelength Creative. So you don't miss an episode of Future Fork, make sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Paul Newnham, and I'll see you in the next episode.